Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The McKinney Fire has charred over 85 square miles in the Klamath National Forest in less than 4 days and devastated at least one community along the Klamath River in Siskiyou County. As of this morning, the fire has burnt at least 55,000 acres with no reported containment. At least 2,000 people were forced to evacuate, including the residents of Wairika, which is home to more than 7,500 people and remains within the fire's reach. The extent of the damage remains unknown, but yesterday officials confirmed at least 2 people were unable to escape and perished in the fire. Rain helped slow the McKinney Fire's pace on Sunday, but thunderstorms sparked at least a dozen smaller fires in the county, and the threat of gusty winds and dry lightning can still potentially fuel the state's largest wildfire so far this year. Joining us now is Mike Lindberry, Public Information Officer for the McKinney Fire. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Good morning. I see a map behind you. Are you at an incident command post up in Siskiyou County?
I am. I'm at the McKinney Fire Incident Command Post in our briefing area. I think it's significant, and it's a big part of the story today, is that we have clear air behind me and over the fire. That could lead to some issues that could lead to some more active fire behavior today, and it's something that we're really going to be keeping an eye on.
Yeah. You know, there are constant updates throughout the day and evening hours. What was the latest information, you just touched upon it, that you can share with us about the McKinney Fire from the morning debrief?
Well, just some of the numbers to start off with. We've upped our personnel on the fire to 1,363. And then our acreage grew to 56,165 acres overnight. Quite a bit less still in the growth than we had in the initial stage of this fire, primarily because of the high humidity and the weather inversion over the fire. Our fire behavior analyst has let us know this morning in briefing that if we are to see clear skies over the fire in the afternoon, there's a really good potential for this thing to get up and move. Basically, those heavy fuels out there that have been smoldering, as soon as they heat up and if they get any wind on them, there is a chance that this fire could begin to move again. The other thing is that we have a red flag warning over the fire area today. With that is the potential of thunderstorms over dry hills. Our air, according to our incident meteorologist, has actually almost 3 times more moisture in it than it would typically in August. So if we do get thunderstorms over the fire today, we have a chance for some heavy rain over the fire area. That could pose a pretty serious hazard to our firefighters on the line and the communities around the fire's edge with flash flooding.
Although the growth of the wildfire has somewhat plateaued in the last 24 hours or so, you touched upon this. It grew rapidly in just the first 48 hours, from 35 acres on Friday afternoon to 18,000 acres Saturday morning, more than 50,000 acres by Sunday morning. For listeners who are unfamiliar with this part of California, just south of the Oregon border, what's the terrain like and what are the challenges?
Well, the challenges of this forest are many, and the terrain is been a problem for, the history of fighting fire on this forest. We have very steep, inaccessible terrain on this forest. And the 3 things that really cause a fire like this to grow are fuel, weather, and topography. Topography and fuels have been our enemies during this. These fires have been fuel and topography driven. Weather has actually been our friend the last couple of days. In the initial stage of this fire, we had clear skies with a real good convective activity, meaning the smoke could and the heat could lift off the fire, causing further growth. We haven't had that over the last couple of days. There is a chance over the next few days that could develop again. And that's something we'll really be keeping an eye on.
Talk to us about the resources for this recent wildfire, because there have been multiple so far in the last month or so across the state that have been significant in size.
There have been. California hasn't been as busy as it was last year at this point, but we have had multiple fires in the area. Currently, we have resources ordered and inbound. We've increased by approximately 400 to 500 Firefighters, since the beginning of shift yesterday, we're now at 1,363. So we do have resources inbound and arriving throughout the shift. That's obviously a good thing because of the potential of lightning, the holdover fires we have from previous lightning strikes. We could have multiple fires grow in the area. So the better prepared we are with the resources, the better off we're going to be.
There have been a number of homes and other structures along the Klamath River which have been either significantly damaged or destroyed. Can you tell us which communities appear to be hit the hardest and what resources are available for these residents?
Well, by far, the community of Klamath River was hit the hardest. They had multiple structures destroyed, and that's unfortunately where the two fatalities occurred as well. We have other communities in the area that we have protection set up for, Fort Jones, Etna, Syed, Happy Camp, and Wairika. We've been working in those areas to get line constructed and prepare structures so that if the fire does begin moving into those areas, we have a better chance of stopping forward progress or at least slowing it and keeping it out of the structures.
Two people did tragically lose their lives in this fire. Their bodies were discovered yesterday morning in a car in a driveway west of the community that you were talking about of Klamath River. We don't know any more regarding their circumstances, but what is your message really to listeners who live in wildfire-prone areas of our state?
That is a great question. And my message is to them, be prepared. If you live in the wildland-urban interface or intermix, you need to have a plan. You need to know your area. It's basically know how you're going to get out when it breaks, you know, when fire breaks out. The other one is have good communications. Make sure to sign up for your county's emergency alert notification program. And you can usually find that information through County Office of Emergency Services or sheriff's departments. It's so important to be aware of what's going on, monitor the weather conditions, and have a good communications with your neighbors so that, you know, you can help each other out if necessary.
There's another wildfire, smaller one, that is burning west of the McKinney Fire. It's the China 2 fire, I believe. What can you tell us about this wildfire?
Well, the China 2 fire actually, as of this morning, is going to be separated out and run by a separate incident management team. But last night, the China 2 was more active than the McKinney fire and did grow by about 400 acres or so. That fire has not received as much precipitation on it as the McKinney has. But they are making good progress getting lines in. Particularly, they're watching the community of Happy Camp and the corridor of Highway 96 that passes through. That fire is now burning on both sides of that corridor where they are doing structure protection.
Finally, Mike, we are very much in wildfire season, which has, you know, now become year-round in recent years. Last week, we talked about the Oak Fire in Mariposa County near Yosemite, which at the time was the largest fire in the state this year until the McKinney Fire. What do you want people to understand as we head further into fire season?
You know, I think one of the messages that I've been saying is fire season is year round. We are now in high fire season. And in the span of my career, 35 years or so, I've seen the size of fires go from, you know, a large fire being 60,000 acres to up to several hundred thousand. And we've had two fires, you know, at a million or close to a million acres. These fires, when they get explosive like this, they're not controllable. So I really think people need to know that if they're recreating, if they are transiting these areas, they need to be fire safe. They need to be aware of what they're doing with any potential ignition sources. And also make sure that they know where they are and have good communications in case fire does erupt and they need help quickly.
Yeah. Lastly, you brought up a good point. I know the fire is still under investigation. Is there any preliminary cause at this point?
No, cause is undetermined on the McKinney Fire at this point.
Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Mike Lindberry is the Public Information Officer for the McKinney Fire in Siskiyou County. Up next, we'll meet a nonprofit devoted to reducing the violence and stigma surrounding the sex trade and learn how a new law hopes to dismantle the disproportionate harassment of women and transgender adults, often those of color. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Governor Newsom signed a new state law which repeals an anti-loitering provision that targets the sex trade. The bill was approved by the legislature last fall, but was delayed roughly 9 months to allow those for and against the bill to weigh in. In the bill, Governor Newsom said that it does not legalize prostitution, but revokes provisions of a law that has disproportionately impacted Black and brown women and members of the LGBTQ plus community. Additionally, those previously convicted can ask for those convictions to be dismissed or sealed. Those in support include the ACLU, Trans Latinx Coalition, the San Francisco and Los Angeles District Attorney's Offices. However, the opposition includes the Republican Senate Caucus and Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. Their argument is that the unintended consequences of this new law will embolden human traffickers and hinder law enforcement's ability to help victims. Joining us today to talk about the challenges of sex workers and what this new law could do is the co-founder of the Sex Workers Outreach Project, Kristen D'Angelo. Welcome to Insight, Kristen. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, I think it's important to lay out the challenges, and we're going to dive into that, and also the misconceptions that has led to legislation, which has now become state law. But lived experience is just invaluable, and you've used that towards advocacy and support for others. I'd love to start with your story, to whatever length you're comfortable, and how that led you to become the co-founder of your nonprofit.
Okay, so I myself am I identify as a survivor of trafficking. I've also been engaged in survival sex, which is how I got into the sex trade. It wasn't through being exploited or trafficked, and then later became a consensual sex worker for the majority of my adult life. So through these years and through this time, I began to see that the laws we had weren't working. In fact, they only served to hurt the more marginalized of us. And it continued to happen. And by the time I had gone to college and gotten out of the sex trade and started doing other things with my life, I realized that I had a very unique experience that allowed me to see all sides of it, where many times people are only a consensual sex worker, or they've been engaged in survival their whole life and don't even identify as a sex worker, or maybe they've been trafficked and that's the only experience they've had. But because I've been through all three of those sectors of the sex trade, I began to see it from a different picture and began to realize that the laws that we have currently are broken. And so the way I got involved in advocacy was through that. I did a documentary to sort of humanize people in the sex trade. And that began my path through lobbying and activism and co-sponsoring laws and things like that to change what was happening in the state of California and across the United States.
Your organization, the Sex Workers Outreach Project, it works to dismantle the stigma of both trafficking victims and those who engage in survival sex. What is often missing from this conversation that you wish was talked about more?
I wish that it was, that's a big question. Okay. So normally when we talk about the sex trade, it's sensationalized. We're either talking about, you know, some lurid crime, or we're talking about somebody who's been held captive in a room, or somebody who's a madam who's made a lot of money, or things that in another industry, like if you've made a lot of money, you'd be applauded. But here, nope, you're going to prison for that. So we always talk about it in a derogatory fashion. People very few times recognize that it's a labor industry like other industries. We're no different than anybody else who gets up and goes to their job every day. This is just the industry we're in. And part of the reason that the things happen, do happen in our industry, in the sex trade, is because we have no protection under the law. Where most people, if something bad happens, you can call 911 easily. It's not that for us. It's a huge decision. In fact, most of the times we don't. So people in the sex trade come to believe that there is no protection. They aren't the same as anybody else. They begin segregating themselves from the rest of society. They live with stigma and shame. Their whole life changes because people don't validate that this is a form of labor, that people are working to put a roof over their head and food in their mouth and you know, clothes on their children's backs. This is, it's just work. And like other industries, exploitation happens when workers can't reach out for help. Just like in, you know, the domestic house, you know, keeping industry or field labor or, you know, shipping. If you go back historically, all of those have had, large amounts of abuse in them until they were given labor rights. And until unions form to make sure that there was no child labor, that people could reach out when employers were exploiting them. So that's what we'd like to see happen here, truthfully. And that's what we'd like to see the conversation to be surrounded, you know, in our industry.
When you talk about, you know, it being sensationalized, I think about, you know, terms and words like prostitution or sex work. Are those outdated or even insensitive descriptions? What language should we use?
Prostitution describes a criminal offense because that's how we've made it. It could have been, you know, a word just like a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, but we've changed that. It's part of the criminal code. So it describes, you know, a criminal offense. Sex work, when I say that, the majority of sex work is legal in the United States. We're talking stripping, massage, porn, BDSM, there are so many kinds of sex work that are legal. Now, are they treated the same as other people who work in other industries? No, they're not. I call them fringe legalization because if you're raped in that, they're probably not going to listen to you. Probably going to figure out you deserved it because of what you were doing for a living. So even though those are legal, you're still criminalized. And then when you talk about the actual prostitution, the honest exchange of a service, a physical service for remuneration of some kind, from some kind of financial help. That's where we get into the area that it's criminalized, because we have this idea that, you know, it comes from puritanical values. I mean, I'm going to be honest about this, this idea that sex should still only be between a wife and a husband. You know, it should only be between someone you love. If you're somebody who just enjoys sex, if you're somebody who wants to get food in exchange for it, there's something wrong with you. That's what our society still says. You know, if you're somebody who just enjoys that physical contact, that's not okay. You know, so I don't even know where I was going with that. But it you know, our rhetoric surrounding the sex trade needs to change.
This recent law that Governor Newsom signed last month on July 1st, I believe, you know, it said it targets the disproportionate harassment of women and transgender adults who are often people of color. What are the biggest changes you think this law will produce?
It will allow people in marginalized communities to walk down the street without being ticketed, cited, or arrested just for being there. Most people don't know that that exists still. What I mean by that is up until, well, still today, they just did a sting. They just cited 10 people right after this bill passed, because a bill passed, it doesn't go into law until January 1st of the next year. So it's still not law yet. It's just passed. So the way the law stands in the state of California right now, we have something called loitering with intent to commit prostitution. And what that means is if you're in a quote unquote area where prostitution occurs. So like in Sacramento, that could be anywhere near Stockton Boulevard, anywhere near Watt Avenue. It could be Auburn Boulevard. It could be Florin Road. It could be West Capitol Avenue and West Sac, any place that they believe prostitution occurs. So if you're in that area, the police can look at you and put together a number of elements and say, that's enough to cite you. That's enough for you to go to jail. And it's crazy because you do not need to commit a crime. There is no crime involved. Obviously, intent, loitering with intent means you haven't done it. You're just, they think you're thinking about doing it. And so, unfortunately, in the arrest records that we've pulled and what we've seen, here's how it looks. Okay, and these are things I've seen written by police reports. Like, black woman in tube top and short skirt walking down Watt Avenue at night, seen talking to a car. Officers approached her and told her to get off the street. If they saw her again, they'd arrest her. 15 minutes later, a woman seen walking on side street near Watt Avenue. Officers stopped and cited her for loitering with intent. So what that says is they can look at somebody and they could just say, we don't want you in the area. We don't like you. So we're going to take and we're going to give you a case. And unfortunately, loitering with intent is seen by employers and the rest of the world when you're trying to get a job as a prostitution case. And it's very hard to fight that, because how do you prove something that's not happening? How do you prove you weren't there? And I know they say that the prosecution has to prove you were intending on doing it. Unfortunately, many of the people in marginalized communities, many of the women who are women of color, they're young. By the time they're 22, they can have five of these cases just for walking in their neighborhoods. We see that with the trans population too. So it's a law that should never be on the books, because people aren't committing a crime. It's just police officers think they might commit a crime, so they're going to charge them preemptively.
What is your response to opponents who believe that there will be unintended consequences to this upcoming law and that will essentially embolden human trafficking?
Human trafficking and the law that was on the books of loitering with intent to commit prostitution have nothing to do with each other. How is that going to embolden human traffickers? That has nothing to do with it. This is something I wish people would understand. So you can change the law 57 times. That is not going to make me a human trafficker. That is not going to make me exploit somebody. I'm just not going to do it. Changing the law cannot make somebody or embolden somebody to become somebody they're not, to do horrible things that they wouldn't do normally. That has to do with human character. That has to do with societal standards. That has to do with economic disparity. It has to do with a lot of things. It doesn't have to do with somebody walking down the street in their own neighborhood. I mean, that's just, they're reaching an erroneous conclusion and pairing things, because that is what I call the call of the wild right now. That's what law enforcement says. Anytime we try to stand up for workers' rights, are we trying to stand up for the marginalized in our communities? They say like, oh, now everybody's going to be trafficked. If they use that word traffic, people get scared and back away because they don't want to see that happen. If they want to stop trafficking, what they really need to do is they need to take and they need to change the elements that lead to people being in those positions where they're desperate and reach out to other people. They need to look at kids that come from broken homes. They need to adjust our foster care system. We need to look at kids that are runaway and try to figure ways to reach them before somebody who's, you know, nefarious gets a hold of them. We need to look at that social and economic equity to families that can't even get out from under, you know, the debt they have, or they don't have enough to eat and things like that, where they're willing to take those risks. There's a lot of things we could do. Education. But saying that stopping arresting a marginalized person from walking in their neighborhood is going to stop, or is going to make traffickers embolden, is going to make it worse. The two things don't even have anything to do with each other. They're not even in the same world.
This new California law follows a similar law that was signed in New York last year. What do you think this signals?
I think we're beginning to change. I think that, you know, we're a new country. And people here see, you know, they see the law and see what's happening through their own eyes and their own lenses. I have traveled to numerous countries and met with sex workers' rights organizations around the world, many of them that have gone before us, much, much before us, for years and years and years before we were even at this place. And I try to find out what they've done and where we're going to go and how we're going to do it. And one of the things I find in countries that have been working on this a long time is they've come to the realization that complete decriminalization, which that means, people think that means that, you know, like people can do whatever they want. That doesn't mean that. That means we just stop arresting people and we don't make their profession illegal, gives workers able, you know, the ability to organize, to take care of themselves, to have safe self-regulatory boards so they can make sure their own people aren't being trafficked or exploited. So they make sure that there's job security and labor rights and health ability to take care of yourself, and so many things that we don't do in the United States because we just don't want to have that conversation. But what we see in those areas, such as, for instance, India, they decriminalized years ago, and in the first 5 years after decriminalization, they saw a 6% drop in HIV and STD rates in the whole state of Calcutta when they did that. Why? Because workers were able to access condoms and healthcare, and the health of workers in your community has to do with the health of your community. So they immediately saw a change in the health of the state of Calcutta overall. Mm-hmm. So those are the things we need to do, and that's what we like to see happen.
Going back even just in recent years, maybe a handful of years, 5-6 years, there really has been a shift in laws surrounding enforcement. I mean, going back to 2016, California passed a law that treating a minor who is engaged in sex work as a victim instead of being prosecuted. In 2019, a bill passed that wouldn't criminalize sex workers coming forward as a witness. What conversations have been taking place with lawmakers in recent years leading to these pieces of legislation and now laws? Where does the will from lawmakers come from, and why now?
It's time. It's time we start looking at where our country's going. It's time we start looking at the health and safety and security of our you know, minority populations and people who are in lower second socioeconomic areas. It's time we start looking at them and treating them just like they're everybody else. We historically have said, if you don't look like what we want people to look like, then we want to get rid of you. And I say that I'm saying as a country. And that's a really bifurcating conversation. And it's not that I think that people want to be that way. But if they see somebody who's transient, they see somebody who's unhoused, they see somebody who's walking on the street late at night in like a short skirt or something, for some reason, it scares people and they just would rather not see it. They would rather them be in jail than have to ask, well, why is this happening? Where have we failed our population? Where have we not taken care of our brothers and sisters? And so I think that we need to start looking at it as we are a community. And if the most marginalized person in the community is not safe and is not secure, none of us will be. And instead of dealing with that through criminalization, we need to deal with that through rights and resources. We need to start looking at what do they need to make their lives better? What do they need to allow them to help themselves so that they could change the dynamics of our life. And I think that once we start approaching matters that way, instead of that, you know, we talk about the prison industrial complex, instead of just throwing them in jail so we don't see them, you know, as soon as we start doing that, we will have healthier communities. And I think that's where a lot of the laws come from. They come from fear. You know, they come from misunderstanding, from not being able to put yourself in that person's footsteps. I always say, you know, if I had made two different choices, I may never be where I am today. I may still be in that situation. When I'm out there doing outreach on the stroll, I know that one accident, one change in my life could change my world. And most people don't recognize that because they've never been there.
So, given that this law also opens the door for prior convictions to be either dismissed or sealed, for those who have been convicted, can you explain the challenge of trying to start a new chapter with this type of arrest record and how this law potentially can alleviate that?
We see people. And so, for instance, I'm going to give you an example of one woman who I love dearly because I've worked with her for years and I've watched her struggles. But she came to us 8-9 years ago. And when she came to us, she was truly a victim of human trafficking. She got in the industry out of survival. She was young and had a child. But 2 seconds into it, she got caught by somebody who was going to take her money and use her. So when she came to us, she was in that position. But she also had had 7 arrests for loitering with intent. So I just wrap your head around it. She was, I think, 23, had a young baby, and had already been arrested 7 times for loitering with intent to commit prostitution while she was being trafficked. We tried to get her a job. And I mean, we tried. We looked everywhere, but everybody would see those 7 arrests and they would view it as prostitution and they didn't want anything to do with her. At the end, we finally found a temp agency that was able to place her at the Roseville dump, working with ex-felons in a program for ex-felons, because that's the only person who would take her. Now, so you know, this young lady was in college before all this happened. And now she's in a program that allows people who are hardened criminals to re-enter the workforce, but she was being trafficked. So truly, her circumstances at the end, all those arrests did not make her life better. They didn't help her. They didn't stop the trafficking. They didn't change anything. The only person, they didn't hurt her trafficker at all. All they did was destroy her life and her ability to get a job. We're starting to see a change nowadays. We really are. We're starting to see employers will go, oh, okay, we're going to look past that. However, very often and technically, prostitution is seen as a crime of moral turpitude, and that comes from way back, but that's how it's seen. So if you have an arrest for prostitution, you are barred from working in many industries for the rest of your life. That includes healthcare, school districts, state, federal, county work. I could go on to a lot, but they think you're not of the character they want. We just had in the United States a nurse who was a woman who was in nursing school who got kicked out of nursing school because they found out she'd worked in porn. And she sued them and she won a large, large settlement for discrimination because they basically thought because of who she was, she couldn't be a nurse. She was actually told, we don't want people of your character in the nursing field. So she actually won and was able to continue going to school. But that's not normal. They just normally are just not going to let you in. They're not going to let you have a job. Even if you get the education, you're not going to get a job. So it destroys people's lives. The idea that it's going to help them, and they say that all the time, if we don't arrest them, how are we going to save people? I'm like, you're not saving them. Like, heads up here. That's not happening. You're giving them a scarlet letter for the rest of their life. They will not go the places that they thought they would go just because of that 2-second interaction with that police officer.
Kristen, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you. You have a great day and thank you for having me, okay?
You too. That is Kristen D'Angelo, the co-founder of the Sex Workers Outreach Project. Still ahead, hashtag West Sac Best Sac. That was kind of a mouthful. There is a vibe in West Sacramento that things are happening, and they are. We're going to unpack the city's growth along the waterfront. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There is a vibe in West Sacramento that things are happening. If you've driven by the West Sacramento waterfront lately, you may have noticed a few changes. Construction is booming, hotels are springing up, roads are being improved, and there are new restaurants that have opened or reopened in the last few months. In a moment, we're going to talk about the growth of West Sacramento with the city's Chamber of Commerce. But first, we're going to start with one of the things to do in West Sacramento that is hard to miss, especially if you're passing by Capital City Freeway. Right next to Sutter Health Park is a big, beautiful setup for Cirque du Soleil's production of Alegria. The blue and white tents are home to the production through the month of August. Joining us in studio is artistic director Michael Smith. Good morning, Michael. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. Well, when it comes to Cirque du Soleil, I mean, I worked in Vegas for a couple of years, so it's familiar to people from all over the world. But often they think of, you know, the Las Vegas Strip and performances like O or Ka. How long have traveling shows, though, like this one, been going on for?
The company started with traveling shows back in 1984, and Alegria was one of our biggest successes. It was actually created in 1994. But it closed a few years ago, and because it was 25 years since the creation, a couple of years ago, we decided to recreate the show. And the big top experience is very different to the Vegas shows. It's not a big theater. It's much more intimate. It's much more intense as an experience. And it's not about technology. It's about just this incredible performance of these insanely talented people I get the joy of working with.
Yeah, the training, I can only imagine, is just intense and quite unique at that. You know, and even just logistically, it takes over a week to set up the show, dozens of trucks full of equipment. How many cities are planned for this current tour, and what has the response been so far since y'all debuted?
Well, we started back in Houston in November last year. It has been an incredible response. You know, we all missed this incredible interchange that happens with an audience because we were also isolated. So this is actually the last city on our North American tour. We are heading to Seoul and Japan after this and then to Europe. So it's your last chance. It has been a wonderful response. And that was part of when we recreated the show coming out of the pandemic. Every show has a universal theme, but what are we looking for that is going to touch people coming out of the trials, and all the things we went through in the pandemic? It was a tough time for everybody. So Alegría means joy in Spanish. So that was my inspiration for the whole thing. We have to spread joy. People need joy. People need inspiration. People need to see the impossible happen right in front of their eyes.
Yeah.
And create a universe that, you know, what Cirque du Soleil does, we create a place where the audience can use their own imagination. So 2,500 people in the audience, I want them all to see their own version of this show.
Given that the last 2.5 years in counting has been unique in and of itself, and just and not to mention just a struggle, I would only imagine as a performer with Cirque du Soleil, the training for Alegría these last, you know, 2.5 years or during a pandemic, how did that impact the training for such a technical performance?
Well, we brought everybody back together back in August before we opened in November. So, but it was, I called people who I wanted to bring back. Being the first show, I was very fortunate to be able to have the pick of the cream of the crop.
Pick of the litter.
But people knew, and you know, these are elite athletes. They don't, it's, they're not able to just sit back and relax. So people arrived in really good shape and just, you know, ready to go.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're talking with Cirque du Soleil's production of Alegría, which is right on the riverfront in West Sacramento next to Sutter Health Park. We're now going to bring in Denise Domke with West Sacramento's Chamber of Commerce. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning, Vicky.
I would imagine having Alegría in West Sacramento is just incredibly exciting for the city, especially the businesses who will benefit from having the show nearby.
Alegría is magic. And it brings happy, excited people. And then those folks leave inspired and joy-filled. So we are delighted to have them back. Yeah.
Given that you have Cirque du Soleil through the rest of the month, but you also had another exciting show or really event in town, the Van Gogh Experience, can you kind of put a number or something quantitative when it comes to the economic benefit these events have on West Sacramento?
You know, our riverfront is kind of the center of an entertainment district that is on both sides of the Sacramento River. So the impact, the movement, the energy for both sides of the river when there's a big event like Cirque du Soleil or Van Gogh, which continues, I think, through August, or Best of Sacramento, it's going to be at Drake's at the Barn. When those kind of regional events happen, it upscales the economic benefit for the entire region. So in West Sacramento, Cirque du Soleil is an example. Those folks stay in our brand new hotels. You know, they're enjoying the benefit of, and not only the staff and the team that is Cirque du Soleil, but the folks that come to enjoy those activities are visiting. We have 4 new restaurants on the riverfront since January. So they're at Franquette, they're at Midway, they're at Teriyaki Madness. They've heard about Sal's Tacos and can't wait to see it. So it's significant.
Michael, given that this is your last U.S. stop before you go abroad, you know, what strikes you about West Sacramento and the waterfront?
We're loving California, I have to say. We came from Houston.
No shade.
People are incredibly friendly here. We have felt so welcome everywhere we've gone, and everything we've done here, incredibly welcome. And that means a lot because we travel to so many different places. Our little world is centered around the big top and the village that we create. So anything that happens outside of that, when we feel welcome, it changes the performance too, because we feel happy to be here. So yes, we're just very grateful and very welcomed.
Yeah, Denise, also, you just have a look at the riverfront. You touched upon the new restaurants. Obviously, we have these amazing events that we're talking about. But you see so many more changes that are happening. From the Chamber's perspective, what are some other positive things that's going on in the city?
You know, one of the most important aspects about that riverfront is that that's been decades of intent and planning, and now success. And because it's anchored by a AAA ballpark for the last two decades. Lots of parking, lots of infrastructure, lots of ability to walk and to move and to see it. So there is public art up and down our riverfront on the River Walk that you can enjoy. You could walk all the way to Clarksburg if you wanted on that trail. We have new residents that are engaged and residents that have been here for generations that are enthusiastic. You know, if you took a minute, you could ride a bike and enjoy a ropes course in the canopy of a heritage oak park that at Treetop Sacramento. So there are so many opportunities, and it's all by intention. That's planning and incredible execution, and very exciting for the community.
I would imagine when you go back to March of 2020 to now, it's really been a 180 for the city, Denise.
It has in the participation of the region in the city, but honestly, the work on that was those projects, the work on the things that move that area together, that didn't stop. I mean, as I said, we've 4 new restaurants since January. Those are family-owned, independently owned restaurants. Those people are planning for a while. And so while there was definitely a pause and a moment of coming together and a great deal of support from both the city and Yolo County for, you know, the kinds of enterprises and to continue the vision that we want to see happen there, it's just watch.
All right.
Just get better and better.
It's just getting better and better. All right, Michael, since you've been hit by, you know, the love bug of California, have you had a chance to get out and explore the area outside of Alegria?
I haven't actually, because I spent the week, we have a week off between cities. I was actually in Santa Cruz because I have friends there. Because I just, yeah, I love Santa Cruz. So I got here and I've been straight into work. But yes, next weekend I will be exploring.
All right, Denise, any restaurant recommendations for Michael?
Well, I can think of a half a dozen, but Michael, the obvious is take a wander down from the tent and visit, casually visit Drake's right on the river. We have an incredible view of the Sacramento River and the riverfront. And then, of course, you have to enjoy Franquette. It's new, and it's Clay Nutting's most recent venture, and we're very excited.
Yeah, from Cannon and East Sac, right?
Yes.
Michael, finally, how do you want people to feel when they leave your show?
Just incredibly happy. You know, it goes back to what we were saying earlier. I think we all need some joy. We all need some happiness. And that's really what the show is about. I think, you know, it's Alegría. I just want everybody to, feel very lleno de Alegría.
Full of joy. Yes, I love that. Does Alegría take on a deeper, more meaningful meaning given the last 2 years?
Yes, it does. Everything about the show is about resolution and inclusiveness. Don't judge and understand that superficial symbols of power we use don't mean anything. The power comes from within, and the light comes from within. So it's all about that. Again, coming back to what we need right now. What is relevant to what we need right now?
And it just opened a few days ago, right?
It did.
Denise, what kind of response have you received from the West Sacramento community?
Tremendous. We communicate with ourselves a lot through social media. And so the buzz, the impact, that, oh, I've got to see this, tell me more about it. You know, we were there for opening night, and Michael's goal is happening. People are leaving optimistic and filled with joy. And I think, and that buzz is taking off. So,
how did you leave feeling after you took in the show?
So happy.
Goody.
So, so grounded and happy and amazed and online looking for my next set of tickets before they leave. you open your life to the magic that is this event.
Yeah.
You don't want to miss it.
Magic is quite the compliment, Michael.
I'm taking it. I'm very happy.
Denise Domke is with the West Sacramento Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for joining us, Denise.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And Michael Smith is the artistic director of Alegria, which is based at Sutter Health Park through the month of August. Thank you so much, Michael, for making the trip.
Thank you so much, and come and see us.
And we do have links to all of that on our Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Hagen. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.